Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Think of your favorite one-hit wonder.
Or that overpriced toy your parents would never let you have.
Or that TV show that no one else remembers because it was canceled way too soon. Now what if we could fix it? I'm Francesca Ramsey.
And I'm DeLon Grant. And after 20 years of friendship, we are now hosting a new nostalgia podcast called Let Me Fix It.
Each episode, we'll dig into our favorite celebrities, shows, and brands of yesteryear, and then imagine what it would take to repackage them for relevance today.
Think of our show as an intervention, but with way less stakes.
So subscribe to Let Me Fix It wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
Hi, this is Ryan Fraser.
This is Troy Daly.
This is Gus Boyett.
This is Don Hutchison.
This is Jürgen Klopp, and you're listening to The Big Interview with Graeme Hunter.
Thank you, Jürgen. I travelled to all these interviews from Barcelona, and our socios, our beloved members, keep us on the road. This independent podcast would not happen without them. Please go to patreon.com/Graeme Hunter right now to become a socio, to become one of our members. And get an extra big interview every month, plus loads of bonus content. So go to patreon.com/Graeme Hunter, patreon.com/Graeme Hunter, and we'll bring you joy.
Welcome back. Welcome back to part two of Big Interview 98 with Mr. John Hutchison. This was, as you know, recorded remotely from John's place south of Edinburgh and my apartment come detention centre here in Barcelona. One of the highlights of this part is John's description of a superb win for Wales over Italy. And if you can't remember the Baggio Mancini-esque pass that John plays in the number 10 position to take down the pants of Fabio Cannavaro and Alessandro Nesta, then wait for the description. It's well worth it. This episode contains details of the run Celtic had to the UEFA Cup final in 2003, and moreover, the difficulty of facing the fact that that famous team won nothing that season, while Rangers won a treble. A difficulty for him and his fellow players. Once we get to the section, particularly around John missing a penalty in the CIS Cup final and then going to Anfield and worrying about how he'd be received, the sound quality isn't what we would normally hope for. Anyway, John Hartson is engaging, interesting and funny. Enjoy.
Neil and I both reckon that you're underappreciated for your West Ham time. Probably particularly, although the first season that you go there, there's an imperative to keep them up, and you play a big part in doing that. That second West Ham season, you know, our research talk about you're second only to Michael Owen for the Golden Boot. You're playing in a team with Lamps, with Rio Ferdinand, Joe Cole, Jermaine Defoe. You know, they would maybe be younger guys coming through and maybe making up the time in training, but I think you got 24 goals overall in your second season for West Ham. And it felt like a fit, John. It felt like atmosphere.
For suspension as well.
So what was it about West Ham that clicked with you? Was it you at your absolute powerful, athletic best? Was it the relationship with Harry? Was it the chicken run? Was it that?
I was ready to go when I left Arsenal because I had 3 years left on my contract at Arsenal, and I stayed there for 2 years. And I remember David Dean and Arsene Wenger calling me in the office, and they said, "Look, John, we'd like you to stay. I signed a 5-year contract under George. We'd like you to stay," they said, "and we'll give you a new deal. I'm not bringing anybody else in," Arsene Wenger said. "You're next man in. You're next man in to Dennis.
And that's not bad.
The righty were two of the best on the planet at the time. England, centre forward Ian Wright, was magnificent. And Dennis Bergkamp was on a different level anyway. What a player Bergkamp was. So I'm next man in. And there was several times where me and Wrighty played up top and Dennis played in behind in the hole. We played that formation several times. But I've also got Harry Redknapp on the phone. I want to build my team around you, John. You know, this is what I've got. I've got good players coming through. I've got Trevor Sinclair I want to sign. We've got Bergovic, who's a terrific little player. We've also got, I'm signing Paul Kitson from Newcastle. I went for record money, 3.2 million, which was West Ham never spent that money before. Kits came for 2 million from Newcastle.
And you're both pawing the ground, ready to prove everybody.
Yeah, that's what I mean. I'm ready to go. I'm ready to fly. You know, I'm 21 years of age. I'm as fit as I've ever been. I can run. I've done all my pre-season training. I wasn't a brilliant runner, but I could get across people. And I could run, you know, as good as I could at that particular age. But I wasn't a great runner. We just hit it off. And Kits, I feel, doesn't quite get the credit that he sometimes deserves either, because he was a brilliant partner to have. What I liked about Kits was, if the left-back is coming up, say, Julian Dix, who was another tremendous player, hard as nailed, Dixie.
Great use of the ball.
Oh, great left foot. And he was hanging off at times, you know. He was limping. He had terrible problems with his knee, arthritis, operations and everything. He could hardly straighten it. And he'd come down that left-hand side. And sometimes, if I'm playing with Wrighty, I've got to be there to play for the left-back to play it into the edge of the box. Wrighty wants to score. He's in there. But Kits didn't mind doing that job. He didn't mind doing my job at Arsenal, what I was doing for Wrighty. That first man, you know, where Dixie's looking for the edge of the box to roll it in for me to either play a back or play the winger and spin and get in the box.
Spin and go. Yeah.
Kits would do that. If Tim Breaker's coming down the right-hand side, Kits would take up the edge of the box. He was strong and he liked to link as well, which allowed me then to get into the box and play the Ian Wright role, play the second striker role, if you like.
And thus probably get more chances and score more goals overall.
Right. And if I say, for instance, if I'm playing with a small centre forward and the ball is crossed over Graham, I'm going to generally go back stick to knock it down for my, like, Smudger was great. Sutton was brilliant for Shearer. Sutton was brilliant for Larson. Very unselfish. I did that for Wrighty. But when I was at West Ham, Kits would do that for me. And sometimes you just hit it off. You know, I wouldn't even say we worked on it in training. We had some fantastic results. And as well as a guy called Richard Hall, used to be at Southampton, head on a stick, Richard Hall, went to Leicester one night, and it was Taggart, Elliott and Walsh. Three big centre-halves. And Richard Hall, honest to God, he headed everything out of his own box for West Ham. We got a 1-0 win. John Moncur scored. That was right towards the last six or seven games of the season. We'd Sheffield Wednesday 5-1 at home. We had other brilliant results. And we managed to stay up. But it wasn't just me and Kit. We provided the goals, yes. But without Stan Lazaridis, Ian Dowie was coming in. Stevie Lomas as well had signed. Trevor Sinclair. So we, you know, Ian Bishop was a really good football player. West Ham was brilliant. I loved the crowd and I loved West Ham.
What was the chicken run like? You know, now everybody's rabbiting on about the idiot owners, a bad atmosphere. Way back in the series, we had Frank McAvenny talking about the chicken run. But I feel that must have been just like flipping meat and drink to you.
Well, if you were playing well and you were scoring goals, then they loved you. It's one of them, West Ham, you know, as much as they can be like a 12th man, a brilliant crowd. When it's not going well, whether it's board level, whether it's the team, they can also get in your back, and then it's difficult to play under that atmosphere. You know,
did some players shrink, John? Did some players not handle that then? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, it's difficult. I couldn't handle it. Once I had the training ground incident, I couldn't handle it. I lost my confidence. I was getting abused rather than being cheered. And I was a young boy, and from being the star player, singing your name, to then sort of booing you and sort of criticising you, that was hard for me to take as a young boy. As much as brave as I was and thick-skinned as I was, I'd gone from being a hero to a bit of a zero at West Ham. And that's why it ended. You know, I signed a 7-year contract under Harry Redknapp and Peter Story at West Ham. And I was only there 2 years, you know. But then what happened was I left West Ham and I went to Wimbledon for 7.5 million. So West Ham had doubled their transfer, what they paid for me.
And it was a reflection of how good you were. I mean, the price was a reflection of how good you were. We've got no interest in talking about Berkovic. Everybody asks you about that. And, you know, football's full of heated moments and mistakes.
What I would say about that is, you know, you can take a lifetime, you can take a career to build a reputation, to build what type of player you are, what type of character you are, and you can put a stain on that in 3 seconds. And I always feel that was the case because I was always a good team player. I was always well-liked by my managers. I brought for certain reasons. And I just felt I always carried that around with me. Although I took full responsibility for it,
I always
felt that people would go, oh, John Hartson, yeah, good lad, yeah, good in the dressing room, good player, blah, 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 blah. But did you see that? And I always felt I had to get over that. I was more embarrassed than anything else. I was more embarrassed because they put it on news at 10, you know, Trevor McDonald, main news. It was on every front page paper nationally in you know, around the Britain. And the bad publicity, everybody had their say. It was like a Roy Keane moment when he walked out on Ireland. It was like, it was like that type of moment where every man and his dog was against you. Every man and his dog wanted you sacked. Every man and his dog wanted you, you know, to be vilified for what you'd done. And that was hard to cope with, 21, 22 years of age. And I think it got to me on a confidence level. They were knocking my mum and dad's door down in Swansea. Press were going to the house and saying to my mum, what was John like as a kid? Did he grow up? Did he have it? My mum was like, no, he was the perfect, you know, he was the perfect young boy, you know, running around the council estate like every other kid. And the press were camped out at the back of my house in near Hertfordshire. The long-range cameras were there every morning. But what happened was Harry Redknapp sent me over to Monaco to train with a trainer that the Arsenal player used, and his name was Tibius Deroux. And I spent a week with Tibius Deroux, and I had fantastic training. I ate veal on the beach. He trained me like a dog for a week, but he was a brilliant man to be around. And Graham, I came back from that trip. I'd lost about 4 kilos in weight. I was sharp. I was fit. And that probably got me right to move out of the club to Wimbledon, where I got going again. But Harry was great with me. He really was. We still speak today. We do different functions and things together. We've always remained very close, myself and Harry. He knows the game is about players, and he knows how to build a team. He gives youngsters a chance.
And when, you know, to compare, when Paulo Di Canio has a moment, just like a split second you had, and pushes Durkin over, okay, he's made a mistake. Who goes, never mind that.
Yeah.
When Canio is vilified, whenever he wants him sacked. And he's made a mistake. He's pushed somebody. If that had been a fellow player rather than the referee, no. And Harry goes, I'll have him.
That's right.
And he comes and he'd be in the top 2, 3, 4 West Ham players ever.
Incredible.
Because Harry goes, I'll have it.
Yeah, what a player he was, yeah. That's right. And not many managers would have even took him. You know, but he took Di Canio, a little bit of a risk, a reputation, but he could see Di Canio needed someone to put an arm around him, and he recognised the ability that he still had, and he ended up becoming a West Ham legend. And I got to meet Paulo Di Canio a few times a couple of months ago. I interviewed him in a Barking theatre, 3 nights in a row, and it was a full house. And I'd read his book, and I'd gone back to all his childhood.
Whoa! Stabbing his brother with a fork.
I didn't quite saw that, but I tell you what I did do. He was a big Lazio fan, and all his other side of his family were Rome. You know, he grew up in a tough area of Rome and everything else, and his dad and his brothers. And I'd read the book, so I was well prepared. But you know what? I asked him 2 questions, and he was away. He was so good to interview. He's so flamboyant. He looked $1 million. He had a tie on every night.
Ah, could you tell now, think now, that when he was a kid, when he was 13, 14, 15, he was grossly overweight. He was 4 or 5 stone overweight. He loved his sweeties, and he tells this himself.
You know, another player we never mentioned, Graham, when he mentioned that AC Milan team of 95, Paolo was in that squad.
Yeah. But, John, he was that good. We've got people that send us questions all the time. This is really good. This is Robert Ryan, who likes you very much indeed. Even though I know Robert's a proud Rangers fan, he says, I recall you, and he's clicked into a theme I wanted to ask you about, because Robert's going to get his question in a second, but you fascinated me. In the research that we did, I was arguing to Neil that you could be both things. You could be a 9, not a classic, you know, 10, magical Messi, but you're generous man throughout your career. My opinion is that if you'd been the 9 all the time in position, never mind the number in your jersey, you'd have scored a lot more goals, and you had a sense of not just working for the team, but you would work for your teammates. And I saw you dropping into positions a lot of the time, or using the ball in a way that separates you from Wright, for example, because Ian was like goals, goals, goals. Yeah. Very, very good.
Yeah, but I like dropping in, Graham, because I had good weight to pass. That weight to pass, when you're 3-on-1 and you're going through, not easy to score. It's going to take somebody with the right frame of mind, who's bright, intelligent, and eventually the final pass has to be with the correct weight. I always had a good weight to pass, and I loved coming off and turning and being able to put strikers in as well. I enjoyed that part of the game.
And when you say weight of pass for anybody, I compare that to the way in which you try to roll a putt, and the putt must roll and be in the area, the dustbin lid of the hole. And
pass the ball as if you're passing it to your granny. Put a bit of care on the pass.
It's what my granddad always used to say to me as well. Pass the ball as if you're passing. Because he loved that.
If I've got to send it off to my right, clever players will pass it to my left foot. So I keep the centre off there. They don't pass it there to make it a fight ball. You know, so you want to play with intelligent midfielders that play it to the right side. I'm favourite, you know?
What the weight of it is in that situation, if they want you to pin the defender, they'll ping it right into your feet so that it comes right in, you can't get it, you hold him. But if they want you to drop deep and spin him, they'll just weight it so that it's half a metre in front of you so you can go into it and turn, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely correct, yes.
Well, in that case, this fits because Robert's talking about, he says, I recall you playing that Welsh team and how you beat Italy at Millennium. The team likes teammates like Bellamy and Giggs, not to mention the late, great Gary Speed and Robbie Savage. He's talking about, you know, regrets about not reaching a major tournament. But that game in, I guess, 2002, I look at that moment and I'd like you to describe what you remember of the moment, not the game, because for anybody that doesn't remember, you go 1-0 up, Simon Davis, who's one of a small group of Welshmen who scored in a European final for his club, a group in which you and Sparky are. And he scores early, and I can't remember who scores for Italy.
Del Piero scores a deflected free kick.
Del Piero makes it 1-1, and you're going, there's about vaguely 20 minutes left, and I think you've had a little layoff just before this.
I did what you described 3 minutes ago. I came off Nesta and Cannavaro. They were the two centre-halves with Pernucci at right back. Pirlo played, Del Piero played, and they're a tremendous team. It was Cannavaro, Nesta, two centre-halves.
Mauri's the other full-back.
Well, anyway, I came off because the second half, we were going well. There were 72,000 people there at the Millennium Stadium. Manic Street Preachers had come on the pitch the minutes before that we kicked off. John Charles was there, made an appearance. Another great... Wow. So the build-up to the game was just ferocious. The roof was closed, which added to the atmosphere. We had a slidey over the roof, and it was rocking. So I've come off. Danny Gavardon's played a really quick ball into me, which sometimes they're easier to control when it's played with a bit of pace. And I just took it, and I'm facing the opposition on the half-turn. So I can't believe Cannavaro and Nesta, as good as they were, allowed me to turn.
It's Nesta who's in this instant, it's Nesta who's come with you.
Yes.
And but he hasn't read you, he hasn't kept up with you, and he's let you turn.
He's let me turn, and all night, you know, everything I did all night in the first half, I got hold of it. I gave it to Simon Davis. I gave it to Penbridge, to Saab. I played it to left-back Speedo, right-side Bellamy, Giggsy, whatever. But this particular, it's in about the 70th minute, and I've been allowed to turn. And I know, Graham, I know Craig Bellamy's on his way. Because as I said earlier, he loved going in behind. And Craig timed his run to perfection, and I've slid him through with what we spoke about, the perfect weighted pass. Craig hasn't had to break his stride. His first touch is to take it around Buffon. And I played him through. And I know Craig, as much as I made that goal for Craig, he makes it for me. Because there's not many players that would have got on to that pass and finished it as calmly as what he did that night. And he put us 2-1 up. And it was just, well, as I said, it just felt as if the roof was going to come off. We'd beaten Italy. We'd beaten the might of Italy in Cardiff. What a night for Welsh football, it really was.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
Chris Brooks says, my question for Big John about on the pitch, the changing room, the life off the pitch that you had. He's asking, where has been the happiest, the most complete picture you felt in your football life? If you sum up everything on the pitch, the changing room, life off the pitch, and you put them all into one big mix and say, that moment is my happiest.
Yeah, it's a really difficult question, that is, because I was most successful at Celtic. I won 3 titles, scored over 100 goals, and I played in Europe, and I played in a wonderful team with a wonderful manager. We had world-class players at Celtic. We had Larsen, Petrov, Sutton, Mialbi, Lambert. We were a wonderful team with an absolute brilliant manager who understood everything about the ethos of the club, what the fans needed, what the players had to do to be successful. He formed that team. And that's when I was at my most glorious and happiest in terms of winning trophies and scoring goals. I was very happy at Luton as a young boy, living with in Diggs with a lovely family called Eddie and Debbie from the age of 16 to 19. They treated me like their own. I had to get myself into the football ground every day. I had to become a man overnight. I left house at 16, South Wales, Swansea, to live in Hertfordshire, 400 miles up the road. And I went in and I had to embrace that different family. I had to help do the dishes after Sunday dinner. I had to chip in with the duties. Yeah. I had to live with another family. It wasn't like laze around in my own house in Swansea. My mother'd say, oi, get your feet off the settee before your father comes home and all that type of stuff. Do you know what I mean? I couldn't do that. So I had to grow up very quickly. And then, you know, getting in the reserves, getting in the first team at just 19 years of age, now working with them other apprentices who I keep in touch with now, we call it the class of 93. They were really happy days. I loved Arsenal. I was very young. I was only 19. I loved going in there. West Ham, again, I scored a lot of goals, worked with Harry. So that's why I say it's a really tough question. I would have to say Celtic because it's a global club, and I was really successful within that group of players. I was wonderfully happy and successful at Celtic, but I've also got to say there were several other times during my life where I thoroughly enjoyed, you know, where I was and what I was doing. And Celtic was a great move for me.
Then let's end by talking about a little phase in that time. And it's strange, John, because maybe had your back not, you know, betrayed you, you'd be sitting with a European medal now. And I look back at that season when it's one of Celtic's most famous achievements, irrespective of not beating Porto and Seville, that the march to that final is regarded as something so meritorious and so glorious that it almost constitutes not failure, but well-being. And also the way in which so many fans went there and there were no arrests and so on and so forth. There's a couple of things I want to do. When this confinement ends, there's a lot of debate, particularly in this country, about how regularly, how often players can play football matches. So there's going to be a compressed calendar and maybe it'll be without fans. And the players' union in Spain right now is arguing really hard that you cannot play constantly every 3 days, otherwise you won't be at optimum. This is you in that season. This is you and your team. So you play a match on the 8th of March, the 13th of March, the 16th of March, the 20th of March, and the 23rd of March. Those matches are 8th March, Celtic against Rangers, you score the winner. The 13th of March, 1-1 at home against Liverpool, you have a good hand in the goal that Henrik scores. 16th of March, a really brutally contested League Cup final. It doesn't go your way. The penalty at the end, you put past the post. 20th of March, you score one of the goals of your lifetime at Anfield against Liverpool. And on the 23rd of March, you lose to Inverness Cali away and go out of the cup. That's an extraordinary...
Martin made 10 changes to the team in Liverpool.
And that loses you that tie?
We went out away at 1-0. I came on with 10 minutes to go. So
do you think that loses you that tie, the 10 changes?
Absolutely, yeah. I think that we had a bit of momentum. Martin had to make changes, as you said, because we'd had such a heavy sort of list of games, fixture pile-up. He felt probably that we had enough with our second string to go through, the likes of Sean Maloney, David Fernandez, one or two other players, maybe Ulrik Larsson at Lawson, you know, the...
Brotto played in goals, I think.
Brotto was a good goalkeeper. We failed to hang on to Brotto. He was top-notch, by the way. We got him from Livingston. We couldn't quite agree a contract. Brotto's agent and Martin O'Neill and Celtic. So he left, but he was a top-class goalkeeper, was Brotto. So we went out, and no doubt about it, I just don't think them 10 that came in replacement to the first team, they just didn't quite perform on the night. We ended up losing 1-0.
Here's my point, John, because you'll never shake the feeling of exceptional displays, whether it be Stuttgart or Blackburn Rovers or scoring at Vigo against Celta, knocking Liverpool out, beating Boavista, who were stuffy and mean and ugly opponents. But in that season, Rangers win the treble.
Yes.
And as a group, you get no medals.
Yeah.
Looking back on, particularly that period of games, the winner against Rangers, handing the goal, what instance, what moments, what feelings stand out from that little clutch of games?
Well, the penalty miss obviously was a big disappointment because Stefan Kloss went that way and I put the ball past the post that way. I snatched at it. I scored in that game. I was 3 yards onside and it was a goal disallowed by the linesman.
So it was a complete mistake, wasn't it? Complete mistake.
Honest to God, I'm not just saying it. It was 2 or 3 yards onside. It wasn't even close. And I knew as a centre forward, Henrik slipped me through. I know when you time your runs, you just know, you get a feeling, like a sixth sense. You know I'm onside. I know I'm onside. And I slid it past Kloss. It's 2-2. It's going to extra time. And the linesman's flag is up. And I'm thinking, I can't believe that. And then what happened was we get a penalty. And we're 2-1 down. I get a penalty. Henrik Larsson picks the ball up. And he throws it to me. He says, John, because when leading up to that final, Henrik was out of the team because he broke his
jaw, didn't he? Yeah.
And Henrik, his first game back was Liverpool, the first leg of Liverpool. That was his first game back, and he scored after a few minutes. So Henrik throws me the ball, the consummate professional that Henrik was. He said, John, while I've been out of the team, you've scored 2 penalties. I scored my last 2 penalties. And Henrik was the penalty taker. Henrik wouldn't give the ball to anybody. But he said to me, you take it. And I thought, no problem, I'll take it. I'm confident. And I missed the penalty.
I don't know, John, probably you've not watched it back, but I've watched it back recently. And do you know the oddest thing? Do you know your face? There's a quizzical expression on your face. You raise your eyebrows as if to go, well, what just happened there? Not disappointment, not anger.
I was so disappointed because when you go to Hampden, you know yourself, you've been there hundreds of times, on a cup final, you get 23,000, Rangers get 23,000 or 26,000 each. There's 52,000 people there. And it's one half is green and white, the other half is blue.
And you're shooting into the Celtic end, if I remember correctly.
The Celtic end. So yeah. I know what, you know, all them fans are going home, they're all disappointed, they're all probably slating me, saying, oh, why didn't Henrik take it? But Henrik was professional and threw it to me. Henrik could have missed it, who knows? And I missed the penalty. So I was disappointed for the fans. I didn't sleep that night. I felt awful. I went back to Stanley Park where the lads would normally go after a triumphant win. We'd have champagne, we'd have a spread of food. All the wives would meet us there. We'd hold the cup up at the front of the stadium, in front of all the fans. Normally what Rangers would probably do if they won a cup as well at Ibrox. And I went back with my dad. I didn't even want to drink. I just felt, just get me on. Get me out of here. Let people down. I got my head down. But then I redeemed myself in a way. Because 4 days later, I go to Anfield and we play Liverpool off the park. We beat them 2-0. We keep a clean sheet. And it was a good Liverpool side. It was Heskey and Owen up top. It was Murphy, Gerrard, Dudek, Carragher, Hippier. They had some fantastic players. And we were outstanding on that. Chris Sutton didn't play because he hurt his shoulder. And we went and they started singing my name, the away fans. And I wasn't sure what type of reaction I was going to get because I let them all down. In my heart, I let them down. I don't know how they felt. But I missed the penalty. And they started singing my name. And I never forget it. And that gave me such confidence to perform against Liverpool. It all went perfectly well for us. It was nip and tuck. Alan Thompson scores, Graham, in the 46th minute. He hits a free kick and goes under the wall. The Liverpool wall jump. It takes a special sort of technician to hit it under the wall into the... Tom will tell you he meant it. I'm not sure. So we go in 1-0 at Anfield, which is a terrible time for them to concede, but it's a great time for us to score because Martin O'Neill's half-time team talk almost changes them. We're on the front foot. And remember, we've got to score. But they've got the away goal from the week before at Celtic Park. No matter what happens at Anfield, we need a goal. Even to get into this game, to be competitive. And then in the second half, again, I'm getting a bit tired, 72nd, 73rd minute. I'm up there battling away with Henrik, and I get that goal. So I play 1-2, and I know I've got, I think it's Jackie McNamara or Stephen Petrov pulling away. And I've just decided to hit it. And like most of my goals were in the 6-yard box, using my power, back post, heading ability, whatever, quick feet. I hit it from 25, 28 yards, and it flies in the top corner. And my mum and dad are behind the goal.
Aww.
And I knew, Graham, I knew that Liverpool wouldn't come back from 2-0 down. We saw the game out really well. And I just ran to the Celtic fans. And that was probably my moment as a Celtic player. That's the goal everybody generally talks about, was Liverpool away, UEFA Cup, quarter final. You know, not many teams win at Liverpool in Europe under the lights.
That was fun winding up this brief chat about a rich career. And you're a man who's been able to handle adversity and learn from adversity. And I know you're a particularly happy man now. So all I want to do is, so Celtic fans who want to hear just every kick of every season, of every medal, sorry, but John's been, you know, somebody who's been important to Luton and to West Ham and Arsenal. We've left out Wimbledon and Coventry, kind of deliberately. Because, John, we wanted to get the best out of your memory bank. And am I right in saying, as I wind up, that although it would have been nicer to have less adversity, you're a better man for everything that sport has taught you across your life?
Absolutely, Graham. I'm 9 years clean. We never spoke about my gambling problems when I was younger, but I'm now 9 years clean. I go to GA twice a week here in Edinburgh, and I'm firmly on top of my addiction, you know, going to recovery twice a week. And I'm 9 years now without a single bet. So that has been huge. That has been huge in my life because if I'm right, if I'm clean and I'm right, then my family is right. And my family is everything to me, my wife, my children. So, you know, in terms of my career, you know, I will never go down as a Larson or a Jimmy Johnson or a Ian Wright. What I find is that I was very genuine. I was a genuine footballer. I give everything I had for every one of my clubs. And I don't want to be called a legend and I don't want to be called a hero. I'm just John from a council estate in Swansea that managed to make his parents very proud. And I did what I had to do, you know, to go and be good at what I was given that gift. I think we're all born with a little bit of potential. And for me personally, I made the most out of everything that I had. You know, I wasn't the quickest. You know, I wasn't the 100 goals in the Premier League type. But I did as well as I could have done, you know, in a career in at that particular time I was going through.
I tell you, that's a nice thing. If you can, if anybody's career, anybody's abilities, if you can say that's your epitaph at the end of what you've been supposed to do in life, if you can genuinely say, I've maximised myself, that's a fabulous thing to be able to say. Listen, John, you've taken an awful lot of time out. I've enjoyed it. Thank you. You're a generous man, generous in what you say, and you've got a nice turn of phrase. You're very gentle with people. I feel that we've scratched the surface on a couple of subjects, but that's because you like being good about people, and that's a rare tendencies in these sort of vicious finger-pointing days. The big interview is the better for having had John Hartson on it. John, thank you very much indeed. I think we've now got at least a golf date pending at some stage. And
let me know when you're up.
And we're going to be at the SECC in August.
Of course we are, yeah. Can't wait for that.
And if anybody claims that they came up with Hail Hail at the Hydro, they're lying. It was me.
Brilliant.
Thank you for listening to The Big Interview. It's produced by me, which sounds egotistical, but it's also true, Graham Hunter, and Backpage. Our music is by Beer Jacket, who else? Editing by Charlie McGarry. Thank you to our hosts at Acast and our loyal sponsors at Bet365. We're also supported by our socios. Find out how to become a socio, how to support us, at patreon.com/GrahamHunter. Here endeth the lesson.